I remember leading up to New York. We get to New York. David Falk calls me like 1 o'clock and says, Seattle just traded the pick. And I'm like, what? And then like, I'm just playing. I said, don't be messing with me.
Then you are in Australia right now.
You're talking NBA basketball. You're talking great teams. You're talking great individual players.
Takes it off and there's number 23. And of course, Johnny goes nuts.
So we're all getting goosebumps thinking about it now.
I just tried to go out there and play my game.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Adam. I don't like anybody. I'm not a people person.
Strand, you made the pass. Yes. Christian, can you catch the ball? Yes.
All the stars were aligned and all the muscles fired at the right time. And I was able to get off the ground and throw one down.
I was saving that as a surprise for you.
And now, introducing your host for In All Airness, Adam Ryan.
Welcome to episode 91. Thanks for joining me. Today, I'm excited to welcome first team All-American, NBA All-Star, and 12-year veteran Xavier McDaniel to the show. Our conversation covers a wide variety of topics spanning X-Man's entire career. We venture briefly into the related field of movie and poster history, and of course, discuss some of his most memorable moments on the basketball court. As you may expect, given his passionate nature, X delivers the occasional expletive during our chat. They are, for the most part, bleeped out. However, please be aware of this if children are listening with you. Show notes for this episode, including links to numerous topics covered, will be available at inallairness.com/91. Now, onto the show. My guest today was first team All-American in 1985. He was a first Division I player to lead the nation in both scoring and rebounding. He's a 12-year NBA veteran and was named an NBA All-Star in 1988. He's also regarded as one of the most intimidating players of all time. Xavier McDaniel, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate you chatting with me today. I'm really excited to talk with you. Now, from what I've read in researching for our chat today, you're the oldest of six children. What sports did you play when you were a young boy, and when do you recall making basketball your main focus?
When I was younger, I also played football, also played baseball. Actually, probably a better baseball player growing up as a youngster than I was, well, I know I was, than I was a basketball player. Growing up playing baseball, a lot of people thought I was probably going to be a Major League Baseball player. I could play any position, could hit with power, hit for average. Somehow I started growing, and basketball wasn't in my future. You know, I played a little bit of high school baseball my sophomore year, and me and the coach didn't get along. And funny, he's our athletic director at my high school now. And when I retired from the NBA and I came to a home game, he asked me, was I still mad at him? And I was like, why would I be mad at you? I just played 12 years in the NBA, so why would I be mad? I think that he knew that I wanted to play baseball. And I just wanted to compete, and he put me in right field, and I didn't want to play right. I either wanted to pitch or catch or first or third. Those are the positions I like the best. And I really loved pitching back then, and he wouldn't let me do it. Told me the only thing he had for me was right field, and I tried it for all the preseason. And right before the start of the season, I just told him I didn't want to do it anymore. And then my high school coach, Coach Sai Sakachi, asked me to come back out, and I wound up playing JV. Only one condition that I had that I would be able to pitch.
All right.
And I did. And I never played high school baseball again. I played, like, a lot of people call it the Brave Rude League. You have Little League, and you have Pony League, and then you have Colt League. I would always play in those leagues. I didn't play Legion Ball because you had to play Legion Ball. You had to be a high school player because nobody would mess with you unless you was a high school player. And since I didn't play high school, I couldn't play Legion.
Okay, I had no idea that you had a baseball background as well. I read a little bit about football, and of course, in your high school years, you started to play basketball too. But
way more baseball than football.
Wow.
I played football for 2 years in high school, and I started playing football when I was probably 9, and I played it from about 9 years old to 15. But I played baseball from about 9 to 18. I played 9 years of baseball.
Okay, wow, that's fantastic. I had no idea.
All the way until I went to Wichita State. That's my first love, baseball.
Who were some of the players that you looked up to when you were growing up in terms of baseball or football?
Reggie Jackson, Johnny Bench, Joe Morgan. My favorite player probably of all time, and I love Hank Aaron, but my favorite player of all time and I never got to watch him play, but he's my favorite player because I used to read books on him all the time, and that was Roberto Clemente.
Okay.
He died in Nicaragua doing a food drive, Texas, and died in a plane crash. He's one of my favorite players of all time. I love Ken Griffey Jr. I used to watch him when he was in Seattle. We're in Seattle together, him and A-Rod. I would take my kids to the game back then. Even after I got traded, I would go to the first game. The Yankees is my favorite team of all time. I love the Yankees.
Well, okay. So you've got a big baseball history there that I knew nothing about. So that's good to learn. So I read that as a high school senior, you became a starter on the basketball team, AC Flora in Columbia, South Carolina, and you led that team to the state 3A title, and you played alongside future 16-year NBA veteran Tyrone Corbin.
Correct. Me and Tyrone grew up on different sides of town, and because of the students being driven to certain schools to try to, you know, schools had to be integrated, we wind up going to the same high school, and both are three-year lettermans on varsity. He got moved up first, and I got moved up second. We played for a legendary coach named Coach Sasakachi our sophomore year and our freshman year because he was also the freshman team coach. And then we went to Coach Williams as a sophomore playing JV. And we got all of us, Coach Williams, myself, and Ty got moved to varsity. But I was a starter as a sophomore. My junior year, I came off the bench, like I said. Then my senior year, I became a starter. I averaged about 18, almost 19 a game and about 14 and a half rebounds a game. And almost four blocks a game.
Incredible numbers. And I also read that you were part of a North-South All-Star game where you were the MVP against some of the state's best players. What do you sort of recall about that particular game and making yourself more well-known across the state?
We were going against Cozell McQueen, who played at North Carolina State. We were going against Noel Guignard. He was supposed to be 6'9", and Cozell is a 7-footer. Andre Hills, he went to Troy State in Alabama, Pensacola Junior College also. They were supposed to be about 100 points. They had pretty much all the best players in the state on their team. And I was on that North team, and they were on the South team. But we had myself, Anthony Jenkins, and Greg Mack. And I was the tallest at 6'7". Greg Mack was 6'6", and Anthony Jenkins was 6'6". Anthony Jenkins went to Clemson. And I went to Wichita State, and Greg Mack went to College of Charleston. And they were NIA school back then. And, man, we played them to a standstill. And I wind up going up by one. I got a steal. I stole it, went down to dunk it, and we won the game by three. I want to say I had 19 points in that game, and I think 14 rebounds and 8 blocks.
Wow.
That was a very good game. That capped off a great high school career for me, being the 3A player of the year and also winning MVP. The only award that I did win was Player of the Year in the city of Columbia.
Great achievements there. I read a recap of that North-South All-Star game, and I'm pretty sure that you had a badly injured hand.
Yes, I hurt my hand in practice, but I played all week. I practiced all week, and I played through it. When I got in the game, I just kept playing. I had a great game that day.
Fantastic.
That game, really, I think it helped me start to become a legend in Columbia.
Yeah, no doubt. I've read some amazing stories about you over the last week or two researching for this chat today. Now, in terms of being recruited for college, I read that you had interest in attending perhaps Mississippi, Memphis State, and even South Carolina. But what actually led you to signing with Wichita State?
Well, I originally committed to University of South Carolina. A lot of people don't know that. I originally committed.
Oh.
Back then, you had to have a 2.0 before you could announce it. And my grade point average was like 1.9 something. So we had to hold off in announcing it. And during that time, Carolina signed 6 guys. And they wanted me to go to prep school, and that wasn't something I wanted to do. I told them, hey, man, you look at my grades. If you could take my sophomore year out, you'll see that my grade point average is well over 3.0. I just didn't do nothing my sophomore year. If you take my freshman year, junior year, I mean, I had a high 2-point something. And when you had my senior year, I had 3-point something. But they elected to try to get me to go to prep school. But once I told them I wasn't going to Clemson University, then they stopped talking to me at all. And I've never been a Clemson fan at all. I grew up right. I could walk to the University of South Carolina from my house, literally walk.
Yeah, I read that you lived maybe a mile away from the campus at one stage.
I didn't live a mile from the campus. It depends on what part of the campus you was on. I lived less than a quarter of a mile from the ticket office. I lived maybe a mile from the dormitories and maybe about a mile and a half from the main part of the campus, like the middle part of the campus. I could literally walk from my house to where the guys eat. Like sometimes they'll call me and say, hey, you want to come up and have dinner with the guys? And I would come up there and I have dinner. I could walk from my house less than 10 minutes.
Wow.
That's how close I stayed. But they didn't. And I wind up going out to a visit Wichita State. And Coach Smithson was like, can you dribble? I said, yes. He said, I let all my big guys dribble. As long as they take care of the ball. He was like, you like to dunk? I was like, yeah, but my coach get mad when you dunk and get emotional. He was like, I'll let you dunk. Cliff Livingston was a great recruiter. I mean, he was my guy that took me around the city. And I just enjoyed myself. And I just felt like Cliff Livingston, All-American, Anton Carr, All-American. How can I go wrong? I can only get better. When I got there, I just tried to learn from those guys. But when it came down to it, it really came down to Memphis State, Ole Miss, and Wichita State at the end. Clemson was still there because it was hometown. But my dream was to always play at the University of South Carolina, and that didn't happen. I decided that, hey, you know what? I'm going to go to Wichita State University and try to make the best I can.
That's great to hear. Thank you for elaborating too. Now, as you mentioned, you played alongside future NBA players, Anton Carr, Cliff Livingston, and I think Greg Dreiling was actually there for one season as well before he transferred.
We had the number four recruiting class in the country with Arvin Sherrod, McDonald's All-American, Greg Dreiling, one of my best friends from college, also was there. And we had a guy named Cedric Phillips who went to Cliff Livingston High School, San Diego Morse, and then myself. So we had the number four recruiting class in the country.
Speaking of Aubrey Sherrod, I have seen his name countless times in research, obviously to do with yourself and Wichita State, but also throughout the 1980s in terms of all kinds of different mentions here and there. What can you sort of tell us about Aubrey, who I know that you're still close friends with to this day?
He's one of my best friends in the world. Confided in him with a lot of stuff. We do basketball camps together. We just best of friends now. When we were in school, we were real cool with each other and, you know, got even closer as we became seniors. We got closer. Our relationship grew each year. I mean, I talked to this guy and Cheese Johnson. You might have read some stuff about him in some of my articles. Cheese Johnson's a guy that I met in 1982 that my college coach at Wichita State prior to me getting there. And when Cheese would come into town, he said, I think you need to work with him. And me and him would just work out all day, going at each other playing. Just try to learn a lot from Cheese Johnson. I try to learn a lot from Antoine Carr, and I try to learn a lot from Cliff Livingston.
Your Shockers went 23-6 when you were a freshman, and you were ranked as high as number two in the AP polls during the season.
Yes.
What do you sort of recall of that first season with the Shockers and just adjusting to college basketball compared to being a standout in high school?
Well, one thing about college basketball, in high school, you're the man. Everybody knows who you are. When you get to college, you're just another number, and you got to work your way. And nobody cares what you did in high school. Nobody cares. It's you on the college level. And what I did, everything I did in high school, I didn't even think about. I knew I'll start. I knew that I had to make a name for myself. So I just went in just trying to learn everything that I could possibly learn. The offense wasn't hard because we just ran a motion offense. We only had a few plays, but we do a lot of stuff defensively, and we like to get out and run. We want to run early offense, and we want to try to create early offense early. If we can, we just run our motion offense. Coach kept it very simple and plain. People try to come with all these compact plays, keep it plain and simple. And so that's the way college was. Whatever coach say do, that's what I tried to do. I tried to learn everybody's position. Someone was hurt. I knew I was on the third team. Someone got hurt. Who know that position? Boom. I raised my hand. I knew that position. I think what attracted me to Coach Smithson was that, wow, this guy's a freshman and he knows everybody's position. Coach, he really started believing in me. My first game, I had 14 points, You know? I think 6 rebounds in 14 minutes. So I think that was the tale of my career. As time went on, Antoine and Cliff was playing very, very well. I didn't get to play that much. But whenever you put me in the game, I was just trying to produce.
Now, in terms of those two gentlemen, just looking through my notes here, Cliff turned pro after your freshman season, and then Antoine turned pro after your sophomore season. According to the Shockers media guide, you wore number 23 as a freshman before you switched to your number 34. Is that true?
Yes, I wore 23 my first year. I always tell people, maybe that's what they thought of me. When we first got to town, they asked you, what's your jersey number? I told them 34. Jerseys came in late. So when the jerseys came in late, I wore my jersey. No one ordered my jersey, so I had to wear 23 the whole year.
Oh, wow. That's a great little story there. Not for you, though. You would have liked to have worn 34, but that's a good story to hear. There was a bit of a background behind that.
Yeah. Then the next year, sophomore year, they asked everybody their jersey number. They had to order their jersey. And I was like, 34. My sophomore year, I wore 32 for maybe 6 or 7 games. And when the jerseys came in, I got 34. So I only wore 34 for 2.5 years.
Oh, there you go. I had no idea.
Yeah, because when the freshmen come in, if you got a jersey number they want, they have to order it. So I was like, hey, man, y'all order my jersey? And they was like, yeah, we got it in. But the jerseys weren't going to come in until about December. If they don't have a jersey with that number on it, then you had to wear another number. So another guy on our team wore 23, so I had to go with 32.
And then you eventually settled on the number 34, which you made famous throughout the majority of your career in the pros too.
Correct.
Something I came across whilst researching, on November the 11th in 1982, just a few weeks before your sophomore season started, you played an exhibition game against the touring Soviet Union team that featured future Hall of Famer Arvydas Sabonis.
Oh, yeah.
You had 19 points and 13 rebounds.
Yes.
And you had a game-winning free throw with 28 seconds left in a one-point win.
Right.
So all that said, what do you remember about that game, which must have been some kind of experience for you, a youngster yourself?
Man, I tell people all the time, the Sabonis that we seen in the pros was not the same Sabonis. This Sabonis could jump, and this guy was dunking on us, and we didn't have Antoine Carnell.
Mm.
Cliff Livingston already went to the pros. I had to guard him a lot, and man, it was tough. But we pulled that 1 point out. I hit one, I missed one, and I kept cramping up in the game, coming out the game, and Coach said, you just got to suck it up. And I said, yes, sir, I'll try. We won out against a good Soviet team.
They went to 4-1 with that loss. It was a 21-day tour.
I want to say, did they play Indiana too?
They did indeed. Yeah, they did.
Yeah, they played a lot of good teams coming there, and we were one of the few teams that beat them.
Fantastic effort. Now, Sabonis hadn't even turned 18 years old by that stage, and I just want to quickly thank a great friend of mine here in Australia, Todd Spear, who gave me the box score so I could actually tell you a few of those stats from that game. You went into your sophomore season and your game flourished. You started all 28 games. You averaged almost 19 points and over 14 boards a game, and you were named the most improved player on the team. Plus, you led the nation in rebounding. Was there a driving force behind that development of your game in that sophomore season, Xavier?
There was no driving force. The only thing was hard work. I just put in a lot of work that summer. Like I said, I worked with Cheese Johnson that summer. Cliff was turning pro. Antoine was coming back, but he had a stress fracture. So I was just working, man. I was just working, just trying to do what I can to possibly improve our team, because a lot of people say, well, you're losing Cliff, Antoine's hurt, so we must be going to be struggling. And I just wanted to make sure that whatever I had to do to try to make this team good, that's what I was going to do. And we wind up going 7-1 without Antoine. We lost one game that was to New Orleans. They had a very good team that year. They beat us pretty soundly. And after that, we won 7 straight. Then Antoine came back. And, man, that made it even easier for us, because when he came back, I mean, Jesus. I mean, you're talking about who I consider one of the best players in college during his senior year. Antoine could really, really do it. And he took a lot of pressure off me.
Yeah, well, your team went 25-3. There's one game I'd love to ask you about in particular. It was in February of 83, and according to the Manhattan Mercury, scores were tied at 70, and there was just seconds left in a game against New Mexico State.
Uh-huh.
Antoine Carr launched a 30-footer, from what it says in the recap, that bounced high off the rim, and then a freshman, Gilbert Wilburn, I think his name was, he attempted a shot on the rebound, which was short, and then you tipped that. It hung on the rim and dropped through at the buzzer for a 2-point win.
Right.
What do you recall about that particular game? And was that the first big game winner aside from free throws?
Oh, I would say when it came to crunch time, I've always been a pretty good clutch player. We already played them early in the year, I think, and we beat them by 40, something like that.
Mm.
But for some odd reason, New Mexico State and Las Cruces was tough. We lost to them my freshman year in Las Cruces. Antoine gets in and launches a shot. Miss Gilbert Williams took the shot, and I just got the tap in at the end, and we won the game. That was one of the toughest places to play. And they had a great team. They had Steve Coulter and Patterson. I'm trying to think of what Patterson's first name was. But those two guys could score. Steve played for Portland. He played about 8 years in the NBA. Patterson might have played like 2 years. But those guys were pretty good. But they just didn't play well on the road. But at home, they were tough.
Mm.
I mean, when we lost to them our freshman year, man, I couldn't believe it, man. All this talent, we got it lost to them. But, you know, basketball, people play very well at home.
Now, this 25-3 season was the program's winningest of your 4 years at Wichita State. However, I read that there was violations against the program that went back to the 1970s, and that made you ineligible to play in the postseason until your sophomore year had completed. How disappointing was it for you to have such a great season as a team and individually, but you were barred from taking place in the NIT or the NCAA tournament?
That's what pissed me off in the NCAA. If you don't find the violations when they're there, then you're punishing other kids that go there that knew nothing about the violations.
Mm.
I didn't know nothing about the violations until the NCAA came to my house and told me about the violations. But I was like, what that got to do with the current team? And we had no violations against myself, Antoine Carr, Cliff Livers. All those were with Cheese Johnson. What's his name? He played in Australia. I just can't think of his name. He was from New York. Ray Shirley. He played in Australia. Ray Shirley had the violations. And those violations were when I was like 13 years old.
Yeah, I read that it was back in 1976 through 1978 or thereabouts. So obviously it had nothing to do with your program at the time, which is disappointing.
Yeah, and I think the NCAA wound up changing the rule. They got a certain amount of limit. But me, myself, period, I don't think you should punish the people who there. You punish the school, maybe fine them some money, take a bunch of their money from them, you know, the NCAA money and the revenue that brought in. That's what cripples a school when you take the revenue away from them. I didn't do nothing wrong. I should have been able to go to the NCAA, and I think they 1982, man, I think we match up well with everybody in the country. I don't care who they are. You could go with Antoine Carr, Xavier McGainey, Cliff Livingston. You can go with Greg Dryland, Antoine and Cliff. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
We could match up a lot of different ways. I personally think that we had just as good a chance as anybody in the NCAA tournament in 82. But I just think we had a better chance. Wow. And then 83, you know, with Antoine and myself and Arbery and Zonko Zerzi, I felt like that team would have been pretty good, too.
Yeah, well, you would have caused some big-time damage, I reckon, when it came to tournament time had you been eligible. In your junior season, you went 18-12, so this is 1984. You were named the Missouri Valley Conference Player of the Year and made it to the National Invitational Tournament and took on Roy Tarpley and his Michigan Wolverines. I read the game recap. You were in foul trouble early on and fouled out of the game with about 8 minutes left. They'd ultimately win 94-70. What did you make of your junior campaign and then the first taste of postseason play?
The junior campaign was pretty good. I felt like we underachieved that year. We did pretty well in the Missouri Valley. We started off slow. Like I think we started off like 3-6, something like that. We didn't have guys playing on the same level. Guys were being selfish. And then Bernard Jackson and Gilbert Wilburn were kicked off the team. And then after that, we just started playing good basketball. The first experience was going against Roy Tarpon and them, man. They beat us up, man. They got me in foul trouble early in the game. And once I got in foul trouble, that was pretty much it. I think I might have scored 14 points in that game, maybe about 10 rebounds. I'm not even sure what I had in that game. That was probably one of my worst games against top flight competition.
Tarpley had 27 points, 23 of which apparently were in the first half. So pretty dominant performance there from a future NBAer as well, Roy Tarpley. In terms of 1984 in the Olympics, you were somehow overlooked by the selection committee to take part in those trials for Team USA. Surprisingly, I would have thought. How did you react to hearing that news of, and missing out on taking part in the trials?
I started laughing because I thought it was hilarious that you take my teammate, Arvi Sharad, but you don't take me. To be very honest, it goes back to something that I basically wouldn't snitch on someone. They tried to say that I was in the bathroom with just my drawers on. And I was like, yeah, I was in the bathroom with my drawers on. And coach said, I said, it was all male dorm, coach. He said, oh, it was? I said, everybody was walking around in their drawers because it was an all male dorm. And when I went to the bathroom, they was like, Xavier, who was making all that noise? And I said, I don't know. They woke me up. And I knew who it was, but I had to use the bathroom. And then they tried to say that I was in the hallway in my drawers, but I was in an all-male dorm. It wasn't co-ed. It was all male. Even if I did tell them who it was, they wasn't going to do nothing to him because he was one of the guys on the team that made the team. And when they announced everybody who was going to be on the world team and who was going to be on the Pan Am team, and they called my name as an alternate. And I was like, why am I alternate? I played better than most of these guys here. And I was like, that's some bullshit. You know, y'all bring me here and I bust my ass. And if I deserve to be on the team, I should have been on the team. And this is what prompted them to do the dream team, because they don't always take the best players in America. Back when I was playing, you could leave a Xavier McDaniel at home and still win it. You know, You could do that. The world has caught up with us a little bit. So when you're talking about taking the best players, the United States has never always taken the best players. If they think you got a bad attitude or talk up, then you won't be invited. And that's what basically happened to me. I talked up for myself. And I was like, anybody here tell me that some of these guys played better than me, then I apologize. And then Norm Stewart, Bobby Knight, they put me out like I had a bad attitude. But all because I spoke up. You know, the politics of basketball. Sometimes they want certain people on them. They want certain names. They want certain guys. I'm not saying Michael Jordan shouldn't have been one, because he should have been one. I'm not saying Patrick Ewing shouldn't be one. He should have been one, you know. But I also felt like I should have been one.
Well, you were having a fantastic run around this particular time, no doubt. And I was quite surprised because I have researched in the past in other episodes of my show about the whole selection process and the 84 games and Pan Am games the year before, whatnot. I was surprised to not see your name on those squads, and even more so now, given learning so much more about you recently. So very disappointing, but I really appreciate your open and honest reply. Just moving into your senior season, the team went 18-13, and you had some huge games, including 43 points at Bradley and 44 points against West Texas A&M. Both were in January of 85.
Yeah. I don't know if they changed their name, but it was West Texas State when I played.
Okay, gotcha. So West Texas State. 13 times you scored 30 or more points in a game, which is remarkable. And on March the 9th, you had a 34-point and 13-rebound effort in a 2-point win against your rival Tulsa. And that gave Wichita State the first Missouri Valley Conference Championship. As I mentioned in the intro, you were also the first player in Division I history to lead the nation in scoring and rebounding, over 27 points and almost 15 boards a game, and were first team All-American. On top of all that, you went to the NCAA tournament. You had a 22.11 rebound game against Georgia in an 8-point loss that ended your college career. So all that said, incredible achievements just in college alone, particularly that senior season. How do you look back on that moment in time, and where does it stand with you now, Xavier?
It was a memorable year, to be very, very honest. And I tell people all the time, and I'll say it again, my senior season, I should be in the Hall of Fame for just my senior season. I should be in the Nick Smith Hall of Fame. I had did something no one had ever did before. If that was Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson, or Larry Bird, or even Patrick Ewing, good friend of mine, I personally think that they would have went in the Hall of Fame just for that, even if they didn't do but put my uniform in there. That uniform should be there. It should have been the first person ever. No one has ever led the nation in scoring and rebounding. And they didn't do it the way I did it. I did it where I didn't even take a lot of shots. I averaged about 18 shots a game my senior year. If I'd have made more free throws, I would have averaged more points than that. But I did it in the fact that within the confines of our offense, I didn't force anything. I did not just go out to set out to do it. It was just something that happened. I caught fire. And when I caught fire, I mean, you know, like today, you see guys, he hot on ESPN, and then you go look at the stat sheet, and he was 7 for 20. I'm like, oh, damn, they showed all of when I'm hot, I make 13, 14 in a row. You know, you go look at some of my numbers, even in the pros with Seattle, 14 for 15 against Denver Nuggets 1 year, 13 for 15 against New Jersey and Seattle. That's when you're hot.
Absolutely. I knew that you were a great player in college, but it's only when I started looking to the stats and getting ready to chat today that I realized how fantastic that season was. Just for some context, you left college with career averages of 18.4 points and 11.6 boards a game. I think you only started two games in your freshman season, so those numbers are a little bit deceiving overall as a career average because you weren't on the court as much.
Right.
But you had 9 2020 games and you had 2,152 points, just 12 shy of the all-time leading scorer in Shockers history, Cleo Littleton. You're also the program's all-time leading rebounder. Wonderful, wonderful achievements there. Let's just talk about the 1985 NBA draft. It was in New York on June the 18th, and your future teammate, a guy you've mentioned a few times, Patrick Ewing, was the number one pick.
Right.
You were selected fourth overall by the Seattle Supersonics. What do you remember about the lead up to the draft? Were you doing much working out with particular teams? How did that sort of work, and what did it feel like to hear your name read out by David Stern?
Well, let's start out when the All-Star game was in Hawaii back in the day.
The Aloha Classic?
Yeah, Aloha Classic was in Hawaii. After that, teams started to bring me in. Seattle brought me in about four times, and there used to be spottings of Xavier McDaniel. Then they were like, we got to move your hotel. Somebody know. They want me to leave out and stuff. You know, people so secretive. And then I interviewed with the Clippers, and I interviewed with Atlanta Hawks and Indiana Pacers. I knew that I would be a top five pick, and that's why I went to Hawaii. I knew I would be a lottery pick, but I wanted to prove my stock, and that's why I went. David Faulk said, I don't want you to go. I said, David, if I don't go, I can go anywhere from here to there. I want to solidify where I want to go. I'm in great shape. I felt good. When I got there, I wound up getting hurt, hurt my neck, but I played through it the whole time. Deadly Shrimp got MVP because they beat us in the championship game. And I remember we had Al Frederick Hughes on our team, me and Arbery, and we had just went up in Tyrone. I'm like, hey, Ty, me and you teammates for the first time since high school, man. So we went up good on the West, and we wind up losing the daggone game. And then Detlef got MVP, and then that's when all of the stuff started coming up. We wind up losing it, and then that's when I started doing the interviews with everybody. I remember leading up to New York. We get to New York. David Faulk calls me like 1 o'clock and says, Seattle just traded the pick. And I was like, what? And then he's like, I'm just playing. I said, don't be messing with me. We get there, and I don't know if you ever seen the draft. It was Patrick Ewing in the first seat, Wayman Tisdale in the second seat, Benoit Benjamin in third seat, and I was in the fourth, and we went right in that order.
Oh, right. Now, I've seen a few photos from the day, but I've tried to find the actual telecast online, but I can't find it anywhere online to even watch back, which is disappointing.
I mean, we went right in order.
Okay.
And I was like, it's over with. I know where I'm going. Now I get myself together. And I went out there and I started working out with the guys. But then, you know, you had to do your contract. And I had been in Seattle since July. And I was out there July, August. And then camp was supposed to start in October. Now it's September. I'm getting close to September. And I'm like, if y'all not going to sign me, man, I'm going back to Kansas. And I'll go back there and work out. And then they finally got me signed. I didn't go back to Kansas, but they got me signed. And, man, the rest is history. I talked to Patrick. Actually, I just talked to him last week. And, you know, every once in a while I come up. And I was like, man, how my trophy doing? He said, well, what trophy? I said, my Rookie of the Year trophy. I still don't care. If he plays 50 games, I play 82. That means he played a little over 50% of the games. I played 100% of the games. I should have got MVP that year.
You've read my mind. I was going to ask you about this.
Yeah, you take my 32 worst games out against his 32 because he only played 50 games.
Various injuries.
That tells you the luck that I had because then after the Rookie of the Year, I come back and average 23 points a game the next year and don't make the All-Star team. Then the next year I come back and I'm averaging 25, but I ripped my knee up and I kept playing on a bad knee and my average dropped a little bit. So I make the All-Star team my third year. Then I come back off the bench, average 20, don't make it the next year. And then 21 and don't make it. And then I was 21 again. Then I got traded my 6 year in the league. It's what it is. But I still think that with what I done in high school, what I done in college, and what I did in the pros, I still think I'm a Hall of Famer.
I've had an absolutely outstanding career, and you've made some really good points there. In terms of that Rookie of the Year nomination, Patrick won it, as you mentioned, with only playing 50 games. But in terms of your stats, you played all 82 games. You had similar scoring numbers. Ewing scored less than 3 points per game more than you. You played less minutes than he did. You had a higher field goal percentage than him. You had more assists, and you were very comparable with rebounds per game. He had one more per game than you.
Yeah, I think he averaged 9. I averaged 8.5.
You're spot on. You got great recall, Xavier. So, yeah, that's obviously, to this day, it still is a sore point.
Oh, it's not really sore. That's my friend. I love Patrick. But I still think that I should have been Rookie of the Year that year.
Yeah.
You know, and I tell people I think I should have been a 4 or 5-time All-Star. But, you know, it wasn't up to me to pick it. So when people didn't pick me, you know, I just get to the point where, just like high school, it's just like college, you know, people just overlook what I did. You just keep doing it. At the end of the day, if you're happy with it, then it doesn't really matter. And I've been happy with my career. I wish it would have went a few more ways where maybe staying in New York or maybe having some better days in Boston. But, I mean, it's what it is.
Yeah. So in your first season then with the Sonics, the team went 31-51, missed the playoffs. You had 32 games scoring 20 or more points. And as we mentioned, you were second in Rookie of the Year voting behind your future teammate Ewing.
Yeah.
What did you make of that first season in the pros? How did you adjust to being a star in college and then making your way onto an NBA roster? What was that like as a top four pick in the NBA draft?
It was like starting over again. And that's how I took it. Starting over. What I did in college don't mean what I got to do in the pros. I got to even be better in the pros. And so when I got there, I just wanted to be in great shape. I worked hard. I realized a lot of people love to go at the rookies and go at them, talk shit. And all that. So I'm sitting there like, you know, God told me, say, man, sometimes you got to fight your way through it. So I start fighting. And, you know, you elbow me, I'll punch you in the head. You know, you hit me with an elbow, I'll punch you in the head again. I maybe got in 13, 14 fights my first year. Funny thing is, I probably would have got suspended in today's game on each one of them. Back then, the most I got fined was $7,500, except for the Oakley fight, but that was 4 years later.
I'd like to ask you about that.
The rookie year, I got fined, I think it was $500 for each one of those games. I didn't get fined a lot of money that rookie year. Didn't get suspended for that one game. You know, the game today is just different. But people who know basketball realize that there have always been a lot of fights in basketball. You know, you do something to a guy, you know, people sit there and, like, you watch the Greek Freak dunk on somebody, then he stares you down. The next thing you know, you got a guy like Maurice Lucas say, play on him and make him drive to the hole, and then they'll mess you up. You didn't do that stuff to people. And when you did it to people, you had to pay the price, you know? That just wasn't what you did back then. Guys were really hammer you hard. Because it's all right to score on them, but when you're going to embarrass them like the Greek Freak do sometimes, the first thing they say, push up on them, make them drive to the hole, and they try to knock you out.
It's a different game these days. You're right. The players are much more protected, and they don't retaliate.
Yeah, they're very protective.
Yeah.
And a lot of these guys know each other anyhow. So when there's a fight, you know, maybe they're not good friends, or they were good friends, and something happened, like maybe like with Oklahoma City. When they play each other, and when Durant goes back and he has to play against, what's the guard?
Yeah, Westbrook.
Westbrook, and how they was getting into it. AAU has changed a lot of that because a lot of these guys know each other before they get to college. Where I didn't know who the world Aubrey Sherrod was or Greg Dryland was. I had read about them in Street & Smith magazine back in the day. They even had me in Street & Smith. So you read these high school magazines back then, that's how you knew about guys. Then now AAU, you're playing against guys all throughout the whole United States from April and May and then in July, you know? So these guys getting to know each other. So it's very, very different now than opposed when I played, you know? You know most of the South Carolina kids and possibly part of North Carolina and possibly part of Georgia because we had this thing called textile tournament back then. But these guys shake hands after the game. They shake hands before the game. I may shake hands with you before the game. Like, I know Rodney McCray very well, me and him. And we would always eat dinner after the game and stuff, me and him, Seattle or in Houston. I mean, Otis Thorpe, me and him may be going to butt heads. We may not talk. We may not even see each other after the game. Depends how physical the game gets.
You mentioned Maurice Lucas there a moment ago. What was it like when he came onto the Sonics roster? I think it was your second year in Seattle. It was towards the tail end of his career. He was also known as an enforcer, of course, going back many years, back into the mid to late 70s. What was it like to have him on the team, and what impact did he have on your career and that time in your life, Xavier?
It was great, and I felt like we should have kept him another year because I was learning a lot from him, learning not to my anger sometimes where I wanted to fight guys. And he used to be like, no, sometimes you got to let them think they won. You may not even be able to get them this game, son. You may not be able to get them this game. You may have to wait till we play them the next time. You got to let something go. He always used to tell me, you can't fight every battle, X. And that's what I tried to do when I was in the NBA. I tried to fight every battle my rookie year and going into my second year. And me and him would be sitting in the steam room, and he would always tell me, you can't fight every battle, bro.
I love it. It's great to hear their stories. Thanks for sharing them. The Sonics' fortunes increased dramatically in that 1987 season. Your productivity rose even further, and you averaged, as you were talking about before, 23 points and almost 9 boards a game. The team added Dale Ellis to the mix, and along with Tom Chambers, the three of you each played all 82 regular season games, and you combined for more than 70 points per game. You beat Dallas and Houston in the first two rounds of the playoffs, and then met the LA Lakers in the conference finals. The Lakers went on to win that NBA title in 87, but this was a huge jump for you from the season before as a team. Just before I talk about the playoffs with you, how did you find playing with Tom Chambers and then Dale Ellis, given there were some reports about some unease whilst you were teammates in Seattle?
I know, man. When I went to Phoenix, me and Tom, even before I went to Phoenix, me and Tom is very, very good friends. And when he was in Seattle, we would eat dinner together. A lot of people try to pin us against each other. But me and Tom have always been good friends. To this day, we're good friends. But for some reason, the media likes to stir up stuff and say things. It could be something like Durant and Westbrook. And it could be something that I don't know. But me and Tom have always been good friends. Like I said, we used to eat dinner together. I love playing with Tom. Tom's a great guy. But we do have our emotions. Tom used to get on me, and I used to get on him. But then at the end, he know that I was his brother out there on the court. And I know me and him done got into it. I mean, we done got into heated battles. Tom, I'm going to kick your ass. And after it's all over with, the game is over with, I'm like, Tom, you know what, though, man? I was wrong. Are we going to meet up at the spot? He was like, yeah. And I said, I'll buy you dinner. You know, I'll buy you and your guests dinner. And that's what we would do. You know, I mean, brothers are going to argue, but that don't mean we didn't like each other. I love Tom Chambers. I love him. I thought I had never seen a white boy besides Larry Bird play the way he played. This guy could play. He's always been my friend. Dale Ellis has always been my friend, too. We just unfortunate had a day where I don't think Dale was having a great day, and we got into it. We've reconciled that since then. I talk with him occasionally. But me and Tom is way more closer than me and Dale. You got to realize I played 4 years with Tom. And during those 4 years, we've done dinner together and different things and hang out. And if anybody knows Tom, then Tom's a great guy.
You mentioned Larry Bird there a minute ago. There's a great clip on one of the NBA entertainment videos where you relay a story about Larry Bird hitting a game winner on you at Seattle.
Right.
Do you mind perhaps just talking a little bit about that moment and just your memories of playing against such a great player?
I want to say it was 87 season. We've been up on them all game, and they came back, and then I think we went up by one, and then they got the ball. Basically, he said, I'm going to say it the way he said it. He said, I'm about to get the ball right here, and I'm about to shoot it in your f***ing face, and we're going to go home with the win. And I was like, okay, I'll be here. And you can see me and him talking to each other. Y'all motherfucker, I ain't going no way. I'm going to be here. And then he shoots it, hit it, and they looked at me and told me, damn, I didn't even leave nothing on the clock. And it was like, it was less than 2 seconds, and I was looking at this arrogant motherfucker, you know? So that's one of my stories with Larry Bird. I mean, Larry Bird was a great, great player, and I knew about him with Indiana State back in the day reading it in Columbia, South Carolina. Our first time I watched him, he played Wichita State. I didn't know where the hell Wichita State was at when I was young, the first time on TV. And he had, 47 points that day? Cheese Johnson had, I think, 30. But I was like, wow, man, this guy's everything. You know, you watching TV and you seeing Larry Bird. And this is pre-ESPN. I don't even think ESPN was out back then in 79. I'm not even sure. He was everything advertised. Not very fast, not very athletic, but could shoot. The instincts were great. The passing was great. I mean, I tell people all the time, it's great to have jumping ability, but if you don't jump, don't mean you can't play basketball. You got to get smart at everything else. Larry Bird was always constantly moving to the open spot, and that's what a great player does.
He was excellent away from the ball, no doubt. You had a standout series versus the Lakers in the Western Conference Finals in 87.
Uh-huh.
They took the series comfortably, but you averaged 24.8 points, 8.5 boards, almost 4 assists and 2.5 steals a game. And in Game 3 at Seattle, you had a career-high 42 points and 10 rebounds in a one-point loss. What do you remember most about playing the would-be NBA champion Lakers back in 87, Xavier?
Well, I'm going to go back to Game 1 where we lost by a couple points. Magic Johnson is arguing with the officials, and we're in a timeout, and we're like, yo, man, he's over there arguing. Because Alton Lister blocked the shot, they call a foul. Then he dropped his head again. Alton Lister blocked the shot. We wind up sending that to the NBA office. Those were two good block shots. That's what I like about the game now, because they show that stuff. You don't have as many cameras today. You can do nothing in an arena without somebody seeing it now. Where back then, you rely on some of the footage, and he got two fouls. He shot 4 free throws, and we missed shots. They wind up winning the game by 3 or something. Game 2 was the same thing. He put his head down and fussed. And they give him the foul. And that's the difference between when you got a superstar and you got stars. Myself as a star, Tom Chambers as a star, Dale Ellis as a star. But we didn't have a quote-unquote superstar. They had 3 superstars. James Worthy, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and Magic Johnson. And then they still had 3 more stars with A.C. Green, Byron Scott, Michael Thompson.
Michael Cooper.
Michael Cooper. I mean, Jesus. So, I mean, when you look at it, what stand out, I remember in Game 3, I come to the huddle and I said, Bernie, let's run our Hawks set. And I said, Nate, when I come off, you drill it to me. But if you got an ounce in your mind that you can't get it to me, because if you get it to me, I'm going to catch it and I'm going to dunk it. If you don't get it, run the second set and then come back to me and post Worthy up. And I'm going to put that turnaround on his ass and we're going to go home. And Bernie Bickerstaff told me, he said, no, Xavier, we're going to go with who got us here. And I was like, what do you mean who got us here? He called a play for Dale, and Michael Cooper jumped all the way up and blocked the shot over Maurice Lucas. And I was just mad. I just wound up going off in the locker room, and I was so pissed in that game. And we wound up losing the game by 1. And I started off something like 1-for-4.
And you had 10 rebounds and 4 assists. I'm just looking at the Basketball Reference box score now. Fantastic game from yourself.
I was 20-for-25 in that game, I think.
It says here 20-for-29, but if you missed your first 4 or 5, then that makes sense. You went red hot for the rest of the game.
Yeah.
November 24 in 1987, whilst you were chasing a loose ball, you had a brief tangle with the LA Lakers' Wes Matthews, and he attempted to kick you, and then your response became a photo that still makes the rounds on social media today. You had him in a chokehold, and then afterwards, Matthews was quoted as saying, I can't wait until we play again. His bald head is mine. First of all, what do you remember of that incident, and do you recall the next time you played against Wes at the Forum?
Well, when we played him that day, everybody knows, you can't really see it. It happened so quick, but if you watch the tape, you can see he tried to kick me while I was down, and something just snapping. I just started choking him.
Because I think it was a loose ball, and then it became a bit of a tussle.
Yeah, it was a loose ball. I kind of slammed into him kind of hard, him being a little bit smaller than me. At that time, I was probably 205 pounds, and he was probably 185 pounds. The impact probably hurt him more than it hurt me. And so he was, I guess, visibly upset. And when he came to the Forum, ain't nothing happened.
I looked at the stats for the following game out of interest. It was on December 20 was the rematch, and you had a 23-point, 11-rebound, 7-assist game, and Wes played 2 minutes and went 0-for-2. So I guess nothing really came of it in terms of the on-court retaliation. In 1988, you were named an NBA All-Star by the coaches to the Western Conference team. The game was held in Chicago. Do you remember when you first heard about that selection to the team, and what do you just recall in general about being part of the All-Star experience in Chicago?
Yes, I made the All-Star team in 88 on the coach's selection. I'm still trying to figure out how I lost the top two spots. I was number one almost all the voting. In the last 2 weeks, Alex English overtook me.
And he's South Carolina, too.
Yes. I want to say him and Karl Malone became the starters. But I was vote getter right there the whole time, and I was leading for the small forwards. And last 2 weeks, he overtook me somehow, somewhere. But I made it that year. Felt like I could have made it my rookie year, and I felt like definitely my second, fourth and fifth year, I thought I could have made the All-Star team too.
Absolutely.
It just wasn't meant to be, so try not to worry about it. Never really got a lot of fanfare anyhow from high school. You know, people look at my numbers and say, well, look, Michael Jordan averaged 30-something a game. Well, I had a lot of blowouts in my game. A lot of games I didn't even play the fourth quarter. I think we were 22-4 my senior year, and I know I could go off the top of my head right now and probably name 10 teams that I didn't even play the second nor the fourth quarter in. And I still finished with almost 19 and 14.5 rebounds a game in high school. When you don't get it, you just don't worry about it.
What was it like to be amongst all the fanfare and celebration? And the game itself was a great one at Chicago Stadium.
It felt really, really good. But at the same time, I really didn't care if I was there or not, to be very honest. My play is not really based on an All-Star game because of the way I play. The All-Star game is more showmanship and fancy passing. That's not my game. My game is more of a blue-collar type worker. You don't really see me make the fancy passes. All my passes are very fundamentally sound. You know, when you're watching Magic and you're watching these guys and they're doing the fancy passing and the fancy dunking, I'm just a hard-nosed guy that brings his lunch pail and just play hard every game.
No doubt about that. Whilst you're in Seattle, you appeared on an iconic 1980s NBA poster, which was created by the Costakos brothers.
Right.
It's titled The X-Man Cometh, and it's a fantastic photo. What do you remember about the photo shoot itself, and how was the reaction from family, friends, and even fans to the poster after it came out?
People to this day tell me they love that poster. We did it downtown Seattle. I'm not sure the name of the place we were at, but we were kind of like, wasn't inside, but we wasn't outside. You know, like, not garages, but you pull in.
Not like a carport.
There you go, a carport. But it was a business, and we pull in, and then they just kind of put the paper up. I got the makeup, the sweat. It was a little cool that night. I was a little scared of the dog. Wasn't my dog, so I didn't know if he was going to bite me or not. Once I got familiar with the dog, took the pictures, Costakos brothers called me in and said, hey, you got some time? I said, yeah. We went over it, and I loved it, man. I loved it. They told me it was the best-selling poster out of all posters they done. I love that X-Men coming, man. Poster kind of identifies who I am as a ball player anyhow. As a hard worker, a fearless person, you know, you come down this dark alley, I'm man enough to walk down that dark alley. Are you man enough to come behind?
I'm certainly not. I'd like to just quickly ask you about Sean Kemp. In 2017, he was a guest on Michael Rappaport's I Am Rappaport podcast. He was asked about yourself. Kemp said this about you. When I came to Seattle, I was a small forward. When I got done training with X-Man, I decided to play center. So I thought that was a fantastic quote. What can you tell us about a young Rain Man, Sean Kemp?
A young man. When I first met Sean, I tried to talk to him like the older guys talked with me. When I first came in, I told him if he ever needed anything, just call me. And I tried to keep my eye on him. I knew he was going to be a great player because I just looked at his talent. And I was like, wow, this guy's 19. He can play like this. My time is limited in Seattle. I mean, I tried to be that big brother to Sean. I love Sean Kemp. He's a great, great guy. But the Rain Man did some things that a big guy wasn't supposed to do. I knew my time in Seattle was going to be short-lived once I seen this kid play, and he just got better.
He did. You played briefly with Gary Payton the following season as well. Any quick stories or recollections about the glove?
Gary is a trash talker, and I'm a trash talker. Yeah. Gary backs it up. He backs it up, though. That's what I always say about him. If you're going to be out here, you got to back it up. You just can't be talking shit and you get your ass beat every night. You got to back it up. And that's what I like about Gary. He backed it up. He wasn't afraid. I just think that when I first got into the league, I thought Gary was trying to make a name for himself more than the team, you know. And that's what happens with a lot of guys. They come into the league and they're trying to make a name for themselves. But I knew Gary was going to be talented too, because I seen it when I was like, man, Gary, man, we can have something special, man. You got to lead us. I told him one time, you got to lead us. Nate McMillan was coming off the bench. I told him, you got to lead us, man. And I don't think he was ready for that role, but they got George Karl, and 3 years later, that's what he started doing. Another good friend. I wish we could have played a lot longer with each other. You know, and I thought it could have worked with it, but going back, when I made the All-Star team, and this is nothing against Bernie Bickerstaff, this is nothing against Dale Ellis, but I thought me making the All-Star team brought a lot of attention towards our team because I made it, and I remember we were in Sacramento. I got a call that morning from the NBA saying, hey, you're on the All-Star team. I didn't say nothing to nobody. Bernie Bickerstaff had a meeting and said, we got other guys who should make it. And I'm like, I didn't ask to make this motherfucker. I was like, y'all could take the motherfucker all I care, because I just want to win. I just want to be able to play in the NBA final. Not the first round, not the second round, and not the third round. I don't play in all three of them. I want to be in the NBA final. So I knew that that was going to cause a little tension, and it did. It did.
So Bernie was trying to put forward the names of another player or players that he thought should be on the team ahead of you in the All-Star game.
When Bernie Bickerstaff kept saying, we got some other people who should make it. Tom made it the year before. When he made it, I was happy for Tom because he took, I think, I want to say, Ralph Sampson's spot on the roster. And then the next year I made it, and that's when Bernie had the meeting. And I was like, man, y'all can have this shit. I don't need this. And I think that's all what mattered to me.
Wow.
And then Bernie said it was nothing against me, and I was like, why the f*** are we talking about it? That's why I said that in front of everybody. I didn't vote on the team. So they could have took my spot. They could have took it. I would have gave it to Dale or whoever else wanted it because it didn't really mean nothing to me. Just winning was what was important to me. Even as a young player, I wanted to win. I used to get pissed off with Al Wood or Jack Sigmar or Tom as a rookie because I'm trying to win. And if you win, good things going to come. Contracts going to come. Money going to come. I just wanted to win. That's all I wanted to do.
Thank you for letting us know about some of the history there. Had no idea that Bernie was sort of campaigning for another player behind the scenes there. That's fascinating to hear.
Well, I tell people all the time, he's a great guy. I love him. Like I said earlier, I love his family. But Dale was his boy. I was Lenny Wilkins' boy. Lenny's the one who brought me into Seattle. Not Bob Whitson, not Bernie Bickerstaff. I was brought into Seattle by Lenny Wilkins. Like most teams and most general managers, when they bring in their people, their people are the ones that they want to do well because it looks well on them that, hey, I brought the LLC in, or I did this right here. And with me being drafted by Seattle, I was being drafted by Lenny Wilkins. And that's how I kind of look at it. But I didn't take it personal with nobody.
Great insight. Thank you. In the fourth game of the 1990 season, you were part of history. Your Sonics traveled to Milwaukee and had an incredible five overtime game.
Right.
The Bucks held on for a one-point win. It was 155-154. You played 68 minutes, incredibly. You had 37 points, 13 rebounds, and 6 assists.
Wow. Boy.
What can you remember from that particular game, Xavier?
I remember I was tired as hell.
I can imagine.
That's one thing I can sit and tell you. I was tired as hell from that game. I mean, it's just back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Only thing I remember is that if I made some free throws in that game, I'm not sure what I shot, but I want to say off the top of my head, I was like maybe 11 for 20 in that game, something like that.
Yeah, I'll have a look while we're chatting. You were 13 of 20 from the free throw line.
13 for 20. Well, I was close.
Yeah, you were close.
I knew it wasn't that good.
So you played 68 minutes. Dale Ellis played 69.
Correct.
Behind his 69-minute game, I think that's the most played in NBA history in one particular game, of course, given it was five overtimes.
Right.
We mentioned this a little bit earlier. On December the 16th of 1989, in a game at Madison Square Garden, you were involved in a fight with future teammate Charles Oakley.
Uh-huh.
I was reading about it this morning. You were each fined $7,500 and suspended for one game. And there was another 13 players who left the benches and got fined $500. What do you actually remember about the incident, which sort of began as a pushing match and then developed from there?
Well, what I can remember from that game is me and Oakley somehow ended up on the floor. And I remember him hitting me and then said, "What you going to do?" And I just stood up like, "I'm going to sneak his ass." And we just started to fight. We went all in the stands. And, man, David Stern was pissed off at me and him and all us. And I knew we were going to Detroit. I practiced it, and I went back to Seattle. Just wasn't a very good day for basketball because we went into the stands, and David Stern did not like that. I caught all type of hell from him and Ron Thorne about that. Me and Oakley, we wound up getting together. I remember Pat Riley in Charleston, South Carolina, was like, "Put a video on, everybody looking. It's the video of me and Oakley fighting." And we started laughing because this was in 1989, I think.
Yes.
I think it was 89. We started to fight, and they showed the video. We started laughing, but he made sense. He said, "Now we fight together."
I love it.
And me and Oakley, we've been cool since then.
That's fantastic. I'm really glad I asked you about that. That's a great story. 15 games into the 91 season, Seattle traded you to Phoenix for Eddie Johnson, who's a previous guest of this show.
Right.
And some future draft picks. What do you remember about your arrival in Phoenix? And what was it like to play for the Suns after having spent the previous 6 years in Seattle?
It was tough. I knew it was coming. I just didn't know when. Because earlier that summer, me and Nate McMillan were supposed to get traded to Cleveland Cavaliers. It was all in the news. Something happened. I get a call and they say, "You can't read everything you said." But I'm like, there were rumors that the guy was in town. I don't know what happened. "We're not trying to trade you, Xavier," and la 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 la. And I was like, "Okay."
And it happened.
And it happened. Basically, that's what happened. It happened. We got traded. I went to Phoenix, and I remember it like it was yesterday because we were playing Orlando Magic. Casey Jones came to me on the Magic bench. I just got through working out, getting ready for the game. That's when they told me I got traded. He said, "You know you're our best player." I was like, "Yep, okay." They were like, "Well, you know, we just traded you." And I said, "For real? Where?" Said, "Phoenix." Ironic, Phoenix was coming in town the next game. So I went back to the locker room and said my goodbyes to everybody. Everybody was kind of upset. And I went on the radio. The fans were upset. Like I said, I knew it was a matter of time because Lenny Wilkins was the guy that brought me in. Bernie Bickerstaff was gone by now. It was Casey Jones. But the GM, Bob Whitson, is the one who pulled the trigger. And most of the players on that team was brought in by him except me.
Right.
So I knew at some point that I was going to be gone. Unfortunately, I was traded. Then I got traded again to New York. New York didn't re-sign me, so I wind up going to Boston as a free agent.
In Phoenix, it went 55-27 as a team and lost in the first round 3-1 to Utah.
Right.
In 1991, a quick side tangent for a moment, NBA Entertainment released Super Slams of the NBA. And there's a clip of you on that video saying,
"Get tough, X, get tough. Don't let him push you."
Immediately, that's followed by one of my favorite dunks of yours. You did a massive facial on Johnny Newman at New York when you were playing with the Sonics.
McDaniel with a facial!
And then sort of did a couple of skips up towards him, and it was very intimidating. You have some classic dunks in your archives. Is there a particular dunk that you did in your career that is an absolute standout for you that you still think back on to this day?
No, but I want to elaborate right now. I had so many. But I want to elaborate on this one with Johnny Newman. The funny thing is, they always show me dunking on Johnny Newman, but they don't realize the play before that, Johnny Newman had dunked on me.
How'd he really?
Right before that, yes. He dunked on me, and I threw the ball at him and hit him with it. I'm like, you f*** on me, you going to show me up? And that's the difference between today's game. You know, the Greek freak dunk on somebody and stare him down. And, oh, when I played, you did that? Guys will try to break your neck going to the hole the next time. So I threw the ball and hit him in the back of the head with it. And the scuffle, you know, everything came out. I got a technical foul and stuff. The ball came in. Rick Pitino was the coach. And they were doing that trapping. And I was on the baseline. I remember Derek McKee gets the ball, looks off somebody. I mean, when I say I hammered that motherfucker, I hammered him. And I just, like, looked at him. Probably one of the most signature dunks I've ever had. But I've had some pretty good ones, though. I mean, against the Lakers, the alley-oop, one-hand alley-oop.
Yeah, from Nate McMillan.
Nate McMillan. It was kind of a bad pass, and I didn't even get up on the dunk that much because the pass was kind of like off, and I was able to gather it and then get it and dunk it. I had a couple baselines. I got Tom Chambers dunked on Tom one time, baseline against the Lakers, and dunking on Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I mean, I've had some pretty good dunks in my career. Man, I tell people, man, all the time, man, I've been blessed to be able to play 12 years in the NBA and since I retired in 98. So the last 21 years, also be able to relive some of those, it's been a blessing. And I don't take nothing away from nobody because there have been some great, great players. And I just feel like I've been a part of that group. So I've been very blessed, man.
Absolutely have. And I just can't thank you enough for taking time to chat with me and share some of these memories because they're fantastic. And the audience of this podcast will absolutely eat this up. So it's just fantastic to hear this, Xavier. Thank you. Just moving on to your time with the Knicks. It was October the 1st in 91. Phoenix traded you to New York in exchange for Trent Tucker, Jared Mustaf, and future picks. Did you have an idea that the Suns were looking to deal you? And how did it feel to become a key addition to an instant title contender in New York?
Well, like I said, me and Tom were good buddies. Tom was one of the first people to welcome me to Phoenix when we got there. I felt like the organization threw me under the bus because the only thing we did was come down and call screen and roll, Kevin Johnson and Tom, and I would be sitting in the corner waiting on jump shots. I could get them sometimes and sometimes I couldn't. It all depends on who we're playing and who they want to try to score. I didn't like the setup the way it was. I felt like Kevin Johnson and Tom Chambers were just like, they were always screening and rolling. And occasionally they would let me come in and screen and roll when Tom wasn't in the game and stuff. And I just wasn't comfortable within their offense. I mean, yeah, they would have been like, well, Xavier, if you get the rebound, you can get in and go. That's what I used to do with Seattle. They didn't have to call plays for me because I've been going to the offensive board. I can get my shots off in other ways. But what about the times when we are running? And I get the ball and then, you know, Cotton telling me, oh, Xavier, get the ball to Kevin Johnson. Get it to Kevin Johnson. And then, you know, me being a team player, that's what I did. I just wasn't comfortable in it. And then when I got to New York, it was just all about the contract. It was all about the contract. If you go look up my stats up until January, I think it was January the 28th, the day I bought my contract. I can't remember, but I want to say it was the end of January. If you look up January, December, November, I averaged about 18 points a game. And after I bought my contract out, my average just dipped. And you'll see me playing 5 minutes, 10 minutes. And I was like, oh, shit, it f***ing with me about the contract. That's why I love the way the system is set up now. You jerk a guy around, he decides he want to go and move on. You can't do that to these guys. And I felt like they were doing me that way. They checking them and not giving me a deal. You gave Mason $24 million. You gave Starks about $24 million. You know, I didn't even ask for 24 million. I just asked for 18 over six. So they wasn't willing to do it. And so I wind up going to Boston.
Thank you again for sharing this. It's just fantastic details. I have had a quick look at Basketball Reference while you've just been talking there. You went from about 32 minutes a game through January to about 25 minutes per game from February onwards. So you're right, your minute production dropped.
Right, and that's what that was. It was called lowering my stats. When I went to negotiate during that summer, the first thing they said was, Xavier, your stats wasn't what it was. So David Falk was like, well, let's talk about when he was playing 30-something minutes a game, just like in the playoffs. Let's talk about that. Then let's talk about the second part of the season. The first part of the season, I was averaging about 18, a little over 18. I felt like I had all-star numbers again. And my rebounding was up around six. I think it was around six or seven a game, somewhere around there. After I bought it out, like I said, they stopped playing me. And then I started reading about how they were maybe bringing in James Worthy, Charles Smith. And evidently they did bring in Charles Smith after I left. But I started hearing about all these different rumors about certain people. And that's when I decided, I said, David, hey, July done went, August done went, it's September. It's time for me to find a team. And that's when Larry Bird retired. I went to Boston, and I remember my oldest son, Xavier Jr., his mama, Michelle, who I was dating at the time, was in Madison Square Garden. She ran the day check. She's talking about, we're going to take care of X. And she almost told him, like, well, he in Boston now. So I called Patrick Ewing, and I said, big boy, I would not sign this contract if you make sure they take care of me. He said, man, I'm going to be honest with you, X. If they was going to take care of you, they would have been taking care of you, man. Take care of your family. And I wound up signing with Boston.
Wow.
And a lot of people think David Falk had something to do with it. But the realization is Dave Checkett and Pat Riley, and me and Pat Riley have a good relationship now. And he wrote me a letter, and he said how he apologized that things should have been handled a little bit better than what they were. I knew we could have beat Chicago if I would have been back there. I knew we could beat them. The NBA is all about matchups. My matchups with me and Scotty, I feel like that matchup favors me. Nothing against Scotty, you know, but there's some matchups where Worthy used to kill me. There's some times where Mark Aguirre, when he was with Dallas, used to kill me. So NBA is all about matchups. Some players don't play well against certain players. I felt like my matchup with Scotty, I say it was an advantage on my side. You go look at our numbers from the time he came in the league to the New York time, my numbers were better than his. Against each other.
Let's talk about the battle against the Bulls. The Eastern Conference semifinals in 1992, you had an epic seven-game battle against Chicago, and you were involved in numerous scuffles and showdowns with most of the Bulls starters.
Right.
In game two at Chicago, I think you mixed it up with Horace Grant and Pippen.
Hold it now. Got a little action here going already. Xavier McDaniel and Horace Grant. And there's the push and the slap with Horace Grant. And now you're going to see McDaniel bump against Scottie Pippen.
In game three, there was a hard foul on Jordan.
And Jordan is fouled. The basket counts and a foul. And Michael Jordan very upset about the way he was muscled.
Xavier McDaniel rotating across, just facially goes after his body to try and stop it. Jordan with the strength, the concentration, and now he is upset because he understands if he lands the wrong way, that could be the end of the season for him.
We'll get to game seven in a minute, but what do you remember about your approach to that series and just how physical and the trash talking, etc., that went along with it?
Well, it was a lot of trash talking on both Pippen and Mike and Horace. Myself, Oakley, and Michael, and Starks, all of us was talking crap to each other. The matchup for me in there was to be physical. I wanted to try to play Scotty the way I played him in Seattle. I wanted to be physical with him. I wanted to bump him everywhere he went. I wanted to always have a body on him. And then secondly, I didn't want him to just walk the ball up court. I wanted to put a little semi-pressure to him. And so that way, when he got to shooting his jump shot, he would be a little tired. And that's how I always played Scotty. Great player. I've always loved competing against him. But I also wanted to try to intimidate him with the physical play, constantly being annoying, trying to be as annoying as I can to him. And that's what I tried to do, you know. It worked. It worked. And where we messed up at, we didn't hold court. We did not hold court when it was 1-1. We needed to win game three. Game three is a real pivotal game. When you're talking about playing in a seven-game series, you take home court from them. You got to realize that was a pivotal game for us. We lost game two and game three.
You stole home court in game one at Chicago.
Right. We stole. I think Patrick had 34 points in that game.
He had 34. I'm looking at the stats right now. You've got an incredible recall, Xavier.
I think I had 16, something like that. I didn't have a bad game. I didn't have a great game.
You had 16. You had 16 points, 7 boards, 3 assists. Yeah, great recall.
I'm not sure. I think I had like the same thing in game two. But we lost that game at the end. In game three, we just didn't play very well enough to beat them. And we came back in game four. And, man, I had never heard the Garden that loud. But game four, oh, man, that was epic, man. I got a rebound over Cliff Levingston, my ex-teammate. And he pushed me, and I shot it. And I hit that shot falling backwards, man. That was a great game, and we tied it up 2-2.
Fox for three. Rebound to Daniel. Yes, and it counts.
They got game five, too. At the end, all these games went down to the wire. The one thing I've always known that you do not want to go with a game seven on the other team home court. The odds of you winning are very slim and none. It's not like football. It's not like baseball where the home team may win 58% of the time, or in baseball it's like 56% of the time, something like that. You know, basketball, you could be the sorest team in the league. You could be the Clippers like back then. They may not win but 26 games, but hell, they'll play 500 at home. That'd be the worst of the whole league. You know, even when I was with the Sonics, we couldn't win on the road, but you come to Seattle, we gonna win. I think we went 25-16 at home my first year, something like that. We knew we had to try to steal another one once we lost. We did not want to go back to game seven in Chicago, and we wound up going back. I was ready for game seven. I'm not sure how many I had in that game neither.
I'll have a look for you in just a moment. 8 points or less was the margin in the first five games.
Uh-huh.
You won game six by 14 points, which sets us up for that epic game seven. Unfortunately for Knicks fans, of course, the game turned out to be a blowout, but the score was more of an afterthought because game seven, there was so much on the line. It appeared to be as much about mind games as it was skill, I guess, at the time. So feel free to go anywhere you like with this response. During the game, obviously, there's a key moment where yourself, Scottie Pippen, Michael Jordan, you were all involved in all kinds of talk back and forwards. Can you sort of talk us through what was going through your mind and some of the things that were maybe being said at the time? It looked like it was just getting wild.
Yeah, it was getting wild out there because we knew we had to make it that type of game. We had to make it an ugly game because you got Michael Jordan. You do not want to play Larry Bird, Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson in the fourth quarter. You go back and look at all those games, and I guarantee you, they seven-game series is, I know Boston lost to New York one time in a five-game series, but I guarantee you go look at a seven-game series, home team winning probably 90 out of 100 games. And I knew going in that game, because game one was loud, game two was loud, game three was loud. I knew for a fact that it was going to be awfully loud in there, and it was.
What do you recall about that exchange of words and the pushing and shoving that was happening at that time between yourself, Pippen, Jordan, Grant, and obviously your other Knicks teammates that were in there as well?
You talking about when me and Michael got head-to-head?
McDaniel posting up and faces up. Called for offensive foul. That's number two on the X-Man. The timeout was called. Both clubs going at each other. Michael Jordan and Xavier McDaniel having words. Double technicals were called on McDaniel and Jordan.
I was saying something to Scotty, and I had like bumped him or something, trying to get in his head. And I said something like, shut the f*** up, right? And Michael came over and said, f*** you, X. I said, f*** you, Mike. He said, f*** you. And I said, f*** you back. And we just kept saying, f*** you, and the officials came in and was like, technical fouls. And I was like, well, f*** it then, what you want to do? I figure if I get Michael Jordan out the goddamn game, into a fight, we still got Patrick Ewing, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
But the referee came in and gave me a tech and him a tech. I mean, Mike gonna be Mike. Mike came back out and shit, man, you know, the fans were cheering like hell and the game just got out of control at the end. I'm not even sure what the score was.
I'm looking at the box score now. It's 110 to 81.
Wow. It was that bad?
Yeah, 29 points.
29. I didn't realize it was like that. I think the game got out of hand at the end.
31-17, you're outscored in the fourth quarter, so that's almost half the margin right there. The other thing I was going to ask you about, with that particular game, there was another moment where you stole the ball from Jordan. You had the whole half court to yourself and was driving into the hoop, and then Jordan came from behind to stop that play.
Here's Jordan splitting through. Jordan with the steal. And then it's stolen by Starks. McDaniel chased by Jordan. It's a clean block. Whose game is it? It's Michael Jordan's game.
What do you sort of remember about that sequence of plays and then just the atmosphere of that particular time, albeit in a losing game?
They see Michael ripping me, but nobody talks about the damn steal I had on Mike.
That's right.
I stole it, but I didn't steal it. I ripped it, and I think it was Starks who threw it up to me. But instead of me just getting it and dunking it, I tried to roundhouse it. But if you look at the tape, he hit my arm. He did not get all ball. He got my arm, too.
And they're not going to call a foul at Chicago Stadium, are they?
They're not going to call that. But we knew that going into game seven, that the calls we get in the day, we ain't going to get them in game seven. So we knew that. I just looked over at the fish and said, man, you know that man hit me on my motherfucking arm.
Just before recording our chat today, a gentleman named Chris Herring, who is the senior NBA writer, currently with ESPN and 538, he put out a tweet. He's in the process of writing a book that has a tentative title, Blood on the Hardwood, The Flagrant History of the 1990s New York Knicks. I'm all in. That sounds like a great book to me. You've got first-hand experience as a Knick of that era, which you're sharing now, which is great. What's your opinion about a book that's going to be dedicated to those 1990s Knicks?
I think it's good. I mean, it's going to set some of the things because, hell, ain't nothing good with the Knicks right now. They're struggling.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're struggling really, really bad. So I think it'll be good to tell the history. You know, Patrick had led that team through some ups and downs, more downs than ups in the 80s. But when the 90s came around, I felt like I was a part of it because they hadn't been in many playoffs before I got there.
Mm-hmm.
Patrick came in 85 with me. They didn't make the playoffs that year. No, they made it in 84 when Bernard King tore his knee up.
Yep.
And then I think they made it again in 90 and 88, I think, something like that. They made it two out of his first 5 years.
His first playoffs went until 1988. It was his third season they made the playoffs.
Right. So that's my thing where I've already had played in the playoffs my second year. And I played it in my second, third, and fourth year. Yep. And then I missed it my fifth year. And that's how we got Gary Payton. And going into my sixth year, that's when I got traded. So when I got to New York, I think I was that missing element to compliment Patrick. You know, and I tell people all the time, man, God damn. Charles Smith, why didn't you just dunk the ball? You dunk the ball, you're a hero. I mean, because you know Scotty, you know Horace, and you know Michael loved to come from behind. And I remember every time I tried to lay it up and think I had an easy layup, they blocked it. And every time they didn't do that, I dunked it. When I think they was going to be jumping, then I tried to dunk it. And that's what you got to do.
Yeah.
That 90s, man, I just felt like I was that missing piece with Patrick, man. I remember when I got traded to Phoenix, and I was like, dang, I thought I was going to New York because there was rumors that I was going to New York, and they traded me to Phoenix. You know, when I got to New York, it's like, this is where I wanted to be, you know, and I thought I could do some things. I got that shot blocker behind me. I could pressure up on defense because I know that guy gonna bail me out. It worked out. 51 games the first year, and I already knew if we come back, we was going to win another. I know we could win more than 51. And I think that next year they won 55, I think it was.
They won 60, actually.
60? Yeah.
Conference finals, six games. Yeah, when Charles in game five there, unfortunately, came up short on those three or four layups.
Yeah.
I'd love to just quickly ask you about the movie Singles, which I'm sure you've been asked about countless times. In September of 92, the movie was released. And I'm quoting from the internet movie database here. A group of 20-something friends, most of whom live in the same apartment complex, Search for love and success in grunge era Seattle. Now, you make, I guess, arguably the greatest 14-second cameo in the history of film. How did it come to be that you were part of this movie, and what do you remember about just recording that little clip for the movie itself?
Well, I got a call, and they asked me, did I want to do it? And I said, yeah. I want to say, was it Cameron Crowe did that movie? That was like one of his first movies. And see, the movie was based out of Seattle in the CD district, right up from downtown. He liked Xavier McDaniel. I was told he was a fan of mine, and will I be willing to do it? And I said, yeah. I signed the contract when I was with the Sonics. Then I got traded to Phoenix, so we had to put it off. When I came back to play the Sonics, they brought a little town car to pick me up. The late Wayne Cody was there, and he's the one that interviewed me. I was like, the first time we did it, I was like, that's not natural. And he was like, what do you mean? I said, we got to do it where it's natural. I said, Wayne, do like an interview. I talked off the top of my head. The only thing that I needed to say at the end was, don't come yet. And that was the only thing. Everything else was off the top of my head. We did it just like an interview at the game. I said, wet me up real good. And I had my shirt off.
Yep.
And it was like at the locker room. When we wind up doing it, we just did it just right off the top, man. And it took me about 30 minutes by set. Normally, you got to keep shooting and keep shooting it. We did it like three times. And he was like, cut. And he was like, man, you a natural. I said, nah, I ain't a natural, man. We did it just like I was in the basketball setting, you know, so it went well. Hey, and I tell people all the time, I got a little residual check right there now for $13.
I love it.
I get a little residual check, man, every time they show it.
Oh, that's great.
You know, when you order it, I get a little check. It don't be much, but anything's possible. Like I said, man, basketball's allowed me to do everything from playing basketball to doing commercials to TV shows. Having a shoe contract where I got my own shoe. I mean, what else more can you ask for?
That's right. The shoe deal was with Saucony, wasn't it?
I call it Saucony, but some people call it Saucony.
Oh, Saucony. Okay. In Australia, we say Saucony, so I don't know how you pronounce it over there, because Adidas is called Adidas over here in Australia, so it's a bit strange, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is that the spot built? Is that your signature shoe?
Yes, spot built, yes. I didn't know why they stopped making them. They stopped making them in after the 88-89 season. I went into the 90 season still wearing them.
What other shoes had you worn throughout your career post that season?
I wore Nike in Phoenix and Nike in New York. And I had just signed a Nike contract, a little small contract. I think I got paid like $45,000 to wear the shoes. I had to repay all the money back when I signed with Xanthus when I was with New York. I signed a three-year deal with Xanthus for about $750,000.
Wow.
It was a big contract. I was like, whoa, I should make more than what I made with Spot Belt. I made $400,000 with Spot Belt.
Yeah, that's a great deal.
Yeah. They were a little upset that I didn't stay in New York, but I went to Boston, which was another big market. Shoes did well. Then I went overseas, and that's when we part ways. I was still wearing them, and I was still under contract.
Oh, okay. I just love to quickly touch on your time in Boston. You signed as a free agent in September of 92. You spent three seasons with the Celtics in a period of massive adjustment for them following the recent retirement, as you said, of Larry Bird. Kevin McHale retired after the 93 season. And of course, tragically, Reggie Lewis died just a few months later. What do you recall of that time in Boston? You had two appearances in the playoffs. You missed them in 94, but you were there in 93 and 95.
Right. That 92-93 team was really, really a good team. Came in second to New York. And we started off real, real slow. I got there as a starter. You look it up. Had great numbers again, but we wasn't winning. We was not winning. You go look, I was averaging around 18, 19 a game again. But we was not winning. And so we had a team meeting, and I was like, man, you guys won 51 games without me. If I need to go to the bench, y'all tell me now. I'll go to the bench. And I'll come off the bench if I have to. And if we want to see how it worked, boom, I went to the bench. Damn, we just started rolling. So I stayed on the bench.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure. I think it was somewhere around December I went to the bench. And we started playing good basketball, man. We wound up winning 48 games that year. We started off very, very slow. I mean, and like I said, I was like, if I need to go to the bench, they reinserted Kevin Gamble. And me and Kevin McHale was the first two off the bench. And we started to mash. and do some things. We finished fourth in the East because New York finished one that year because we knew we had to meet them in the second round. And I thought that was a good matchup for us. But Reggie went down, man, and we never recovered. We never recovered from that. I remember in game four in Charlotte, I was like, Chris, just call the timeout. Because I remember in Seattle, we had to call two timeouts to advance. The rules state if you get a rebound and move the ball up and then call a timeout, you can't advance it unless you call a second timeout. Nobody knew the damn rule but me. And I was like, just call it. And Rick Fox got a violation in the backcourt. And Alonzo hit that shot. And man, that was sickening to go back. And they read the rule. And I was right. And so we wind up losing that game. And then Reggie Lewis died that summer. And man, the team just went crazy, man. People started getting fired. Mr. Gabbett resigned. And Jan Volk took over, I think. And things just got hectic. And then we went from 48 wins to 31 wins, I think, that year. And then we came back against Shaq in 95 season. I think they had the number one record. We had the number eight record in the East. I think we won 35 games that year.
Yeah, you won 35.
Beat them in game two, but lost two in Boston. And I didn't have a very good series in that game. Probably the worst series I ever played in my life. Pee Wee all the way up to the pros. I started catching fire at the end. It was too late, man. And I knew that was going to be the end of my run in Boston. And I wound up going overseas for a year and then coming back and playing 2 years in New Jersey.
How did you find that time overseas playing in Greece? I think you made it as far as a finalist in the Greek Cup. You averaged about 20 points and 9 boards in your time overseas. What was that like to play over there? And I think at the same time, Dominique Wilkins, who was a former teammate with you in Boston as well, he played over in Greece too.
Yeah, Dominique was over there. We got together when our schedule permit. I came to town. He was taking me places because he was in Athens and I was in Thessalonica, Greece, which is like in the mountains.
Right. What was the game like compared to the NBA?
Arenas were smaller for where Dominique played and Olympiacos played. They had big arenas. Where I played, it was like a high school gym. I'm so humble that didn't matter where I went, I didn't mind the bus ride. I didn't mind sometimes sitting on the plane. And we in Israel, they make us get off the plane, get on the plane, get off the plane, get on the plane, grab your luggage. They leave luggage. If nobody don't pick up luggage, you know, because of all the stuff that goes on in Israel and all the bombing and stuff, man, they're very secure. It did bother me, man. I was just happy to be playing basketball, trying to reinvent myself again over there. And I knew I had maybe 4 years left to play. I came back because I really wanted to play in the NBA again. And I played 2 years in New Jersey. And I kind of walked away from the game. I was in New Jersey. I wasn't playing. And I told Calipari, I said, look, man, I ain't never played for money. I would have played this game for free. But unfortunately, you couldn't play for free because you had to have a contract and you had to pay. I appreciate my time here, man. I appreciate you, man. I'm going to walk away from the game. And he said, okay. And I walked away.
Did you entertain any other offers to play anywhere else outside the NBA once you left?
I had a couple offers overseas, none in the NBA, but I had a couple of them overseas, and I decided not to. I was done. I was 35. Body was beat up, and I'm done. 20 years later, body is still beat up and even worse than it was then. So knees are bad.
Yeah.
Doc talking about my right knee, needing a knee replacement. So I'm happy. I may not like the way it is. I may have never gotten to play into a finals, but I tell people all the time, because I didn't get to play in the finals and I did score over 15,000 points, that still didn't think that I shouldn't be a Naismith Hall of Famer. I look at some guys, I see Dino Roger made it. So I'm like, high school, college, and professional. Naismith Hall of Fame is about all three of them.
True.
And my thing with getting in it would be saying that I'm a Hall of Famer for what I did in college, being the first person to lead the nation in scoring and rebounding.
Yeah, absolutely. I noticed that in 2006, you were inducted into the Kansas Sports Hall of Fame. And I found a great clip online, actually, where it seems that you endured all kinds of delays in actually making it to the ceremony in time.
Yeah, me and my kids' flights were, man. Our flight was canceled. Our bags were lost. We had the same clothes on for 3 days. Sitting in the airport, trying to get there.
That was a great little clip. But what was that honour like to be inducted into the Kansas Sports Hall of Fame? I think back in 1991, you were inducted into the Wichita Sports Hall of Fame.
Right.
Your number was retired at Wichita State. Those are some great honours to look back on all these years later.
Like I said, man, I've been fortunate. I played for some great coaches, Coach Smithson, who lives in Florida, and also assistant coach, Coach Rick Shore, who lives in Florida also, right outside of Miami, Fort Lauderdale. Coach Smithson was in, I know the town, I just can't think of it right now. He was coaching Central Florida Community College. He's still in that town. I'm not sure where Jeff Jones is at. I had some really good coaches, man, from a high school coach, Coach Sasakachi, to Coach Williams, who took over. Coach Williams was a great mentor for me, great father figure. Just love to death, man. And to the day, we always try to meet once a month and have lunch. Like I said, my college coaches were great. And I had some great coaches, Bernie Bickerstaff, Casey Jones, Hall of Famer, Chris Ford, late Cop Fitzsimmons, Pat Riley. All these guys have been great and have been an instrumental part of my career. You know, and I may have never told all of them, but I got a chance today to say thank you for every coach I had, from one of my first coaches. And when we would lose a game, he would make us fight. So all my coaches, man, I thank all my coaches, man, that helped me on the way.
That's great to hear. What's your involvement these days with basketball? I've seen a few clips on YouTube where you've got involvement in some respects. What are you doing these days, Xavier?
Right now, I'm not doing anything with Wichita State. I just watch them. That's my alma mater. I love them. Coach Marshall is the coach. I got my own business, 34X Main LLC, and I rent houses out.
Excellent.
I try to stay a little busy.
Basketball Digest had a regular feature which was called The Game I'll Never Forget. We've likely touched on it. Is there one game from your career that stands out more than any other?
The game that I'm going to say stands out for me, on high school winning the state championship. That was probably the greatest game in high school that I had, and I did it against a seven-footer, Cozell McQueen, and his brother who's 6'9", and Dwayne Grace, about 6'6". But I've had a lot of great, great games.
Great to hear. We mentioned a couple of your jersey numbers earlier. Was there any particular significance to the jersey number that you wore throughout your career? You had 34 for a majority of the career, but also rocked 35, 32, 31 as well.
In high school, I wore 34. In college, I wore 23 and 32. Those are alternate numbers since I couldn't get 34. Kevin Gamble wore 34 in Boston for 2 years. Phoenix, I wore 35 because Tim Perry wore 34.
Uh-huh.
And then in the All-Star game, I wore 35 because Akeem Olajuwon had seniority over me. So I had to wear 35 in the All-Star game. So I only wore those other numbers as when I couldn't get 34. I also wore 1 year in football, too, 34.
Okay.
It doesn't really mean anything. It's just a number that I had wore for so long that that's the number that I like.
Xavier, it's been fantastic to have you on the show. I can't thank you enough for making time to speak with me for this period of time. I wish you all the best in whatever is ahead, and hopefully one day we can have a chance to do this again and maybe chat a bit more about some old school hoops.
Hey, anytime you want to call me, you got my Skype number. Hey, man, I love talking basketball. This is what I do. All right, thank you.
Thanks for listening. I welcome your interaction with the show. You can suggest topics or guests you want to hear conversations with. Leave a voicemail. Simply visit inallairness.com/voice. Click start recording. Leave your message and press stop. You can even listen back before submitting. Press send and you're done. Worldwide, the show recently had its 100th rating on Apple Podcasts, which is fantastic. The show's average is an outstanding 4.5 stars out of 5. So thank you very much for your continued support. If you add a review of the show, I'd love to read it out on a future episode. Your ratings and reviews are one of the best ways to support the podcast. If you enjoy the show, please do tell your basketball-loving friends about it. Word-of-mouth recommendations are worth their weight in gold. Stay up to date with my podcast and subscribe to my email newsletter. You'll receive exclusive details on upcoming podcast episodes, future high-profile guests to appear on the show, and much more. Simply visit inallairness.com/news. You can subscribe to my show in various ways. Search for In All Airness, 3 words, on your podcast app of choice. The show was on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Overcast, Android, Pocket Casts, and more. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show and share my web address with your friends and colleagues, inallairness.com. Check out the podcast archive for plenty more episodes with high-profile guests. Follow me on Twitter at inallairness. Please add your like to the show's social hub, facebook.com/inallairness. Join me next time for another edition of the show.